The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Maya Salovitz is an award-winning writer and journalist. She's a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and has written for numerous other publications, including Time, Wired, Elle, The Nation, Scientific American. Her most recent book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. It's the first history of the movement aimed at focusing drug policy on minimizing harms, not highs. It's just been released as a paperback. And she's on the line with me now. Maya, how you doing?
I am good, and you?
I'm, you know, it's not bad, not bad. Could be worse, could be worse.
Yeah,
it's not raining,
true.
So. And I'm indoors, right? There's so much going on that I want to ask you about, but let's start with the book. Let's start with Undoing Drugs. I mean, what led you to write Undoing Drugs?
So a lot of people over many years said that they were going to write a history of harm reduction, and nobody did. So I guess I figured I have to be the one because I know or knew a lot of the key players, and I was saved by it personally. And it's such an important idea. I wanted it to have a really good history.
And it is too. I mean, it's absolutely tremendous. I've given copies out. I loaned it. My copy, finally got my copy back from the person I loaned it to. I mean, it's just, there's so many great stories. I mean, what's been the response? What's been the response so far?
People have really loved it. It's been really nice. I mean, you're always afraid when you're writing about a movement that, you know, people are going to be upset because, you know, they got left out or you portrayed them in a way that they didn't like and all of these kinds of things. Whenever you're writing about human beings, this is going to happen. But I have been pleasantly surprised by the fact that people have really loved this. And part of it, I think, was because I wrote right in the beginning that this is not going to be inclusive because otherwise I'd have to write a 10,000 page book that no one would read. And so I was obviously as inclusive as possible, but I could not encompass everybody who made a contribution because so many people did. I mean, it is a movement, and so many people worked really hard to develop these ideas, to promote them, to put them into action. And so I think we need a lot of other histories of harm reduction to get at the gaps that I was not able to include.
Maybe someone will be prompted by, hey, what about my story, and decide to do their own thing as a result. You know, I think it's a brilliant book, which isn't really surprising. I think you're a remarkably talented writer. You're a subject matter expert on drugs, drug policies, their impacts, addiction, harm reduction, recovery. If it's not already obvious, then I should mention I am a fan.
Thank you so much.
And okay, we talked about when we talked last year when your book was just coming out. I picked a few stories at random. What are two of your favorite stories out of this?
I mean, there are so many. It is kind of hard to pick just one. I actually was talking to Edith Springer this morning, and her story is quite incredible. She literally trained thousands of people in harm reduction, and she was probably, if you had to pick one person who was most responsible for spreading the idea in the United States, Edith Springer would have to be on that list. And she was a social worker, and she's a person who has used drugs. And she just did this amazing job telling people what harm reduction is, meeting people where they are, and convincing them that this was a good idea. And one of the lessons I really learned from her is that you have to meet people where they are, even when they're people who disagree with you. Instead of being like, you're wrong and bad, and this is not a good idea, which is sort of my tendency. You have to meet people where they are. And if you can do that, you have a much better chance of convincing them of things and of developing mutual understanding of what the problem actually is. But when I have seen, as is the case, that there is this crazy politics used to attack harm reduction, I tend to want to attack back because some of that is not in good faith.
Well, you know, if it's all right with you, could we shift gears? I wonder, because good stuff and bad stuff happening in harm reduction. Could we talk about some of the stuff that's been happening lately? I mean, we can start with the good news first. New York City, home to the first legally authorized supervised consumption sites in the United States, On Point operating two sites in the city. They officially opened on November 30th of 2021. They've already reversed hundreds of overdoses, at least 400 the last thing I looked at, which was weeks ago. They've saved hundreds of lives. Talk to me a minute about On Point.
Oh, sure. I actually recently got the opportunity to visit there, and it is really amazing to see what they're doing. There's so much energy. There's so much kindness. There's such care taken. And I mean, this, I always get struck by this when I visit harm reduction sites, but you know, they have like warm towels for people. So, you know, when they are injecting, it helps bring the veins up. It also just feels nice. And it's just a comforting thing. And it's one of those things that, you know, I don't know, like if somebody did this for you just as a person, you know, oh, here's a warm towel, you would feel warmly towards them because it's just a nice gesture, like when they do that on airplanes. It's just thoughtful is the word I want. And, you know, the people that need harm reduction services so often are people that are just stomped on and spat on and you just treated terribly. So, you know, when you see this place that cares, what really, really, really annoys me is when people make this enabling argument that like, oh, you can't be nice to people who are actively addicted because that will make them stay addicted longer. And the reality is just the opposite. If you treat people respectfully and kindly, they start to think better of themselves. And when they start to care about their own health, it's kind of hard not to look at, well, maybe the drug use is impacting this. And so it's just so frustrating because it's so counterintuitive to people. I mean, I think, you know, anybody who's kind of religious or spiritual will get it in the sense that, you know, kindness is incredibly powerful. But if you are just seeing the world kind of in a transactional way, it's very difficult to, you know, get your head around it. And so it's just like, well, of course, like you're being nice to them, so they're going to continue their behavior. I guess it's a behaviorist approach or something, but whatever it is, it's just false. Like this whole enabling concept, if enabling were really a phenomenon that causes harm, then handing out needles, giving out free heroin, being nice to people who use drugs should extend people's addictions. And that's what they always claim will happen. But then you look at the actual research and people who participate in harm reduction are more likely to become healthier, including more likely to seek more traditional forms of recovery.
It's like if you treat someone like they're a human being, they might start to care for themselves like they're a human being.
Well, and I mean, I think like, it shouldn't be this hard, but like, if you really, people live up to or down to your expectations often. And we know this, you know, about school children or just in our relationships. But, you know, and you can certainly get into a very dysfunctional relationship where if you expect the person to, you know, not live up to your expectations, then it can create this whole vicious cycle. So a lot of people know about that from your personal life. And of course, this doesn't mean that, you know, you be nice to someone and instantly they're abstinent for life. But it does mean that people engage in a process of change that is slow and that requires support. Because any habit that you have, I mean, even something like brushing your teeth, I feel really guilty if I don't brush my teeth. Like that's a little urge to brush my teeth. Now, this is not as strong as the urge to, you know, take heroin or something like that. But if you understand that these habits are built in and they will nag you if you don't engage in them, you understand that it's hard to instantly change. Now, I don't want to give up brushing my teeth. I think that would be a terrible idea. But it would be a hard pattern for me to change at this point because I would feel guilty. And similarly, if you are using drugs and you believe that this is the only thing that gives you safety and comfort and makes your life okay, that's going to be really hard to stop because not only do you have that, you know, sort of passion attached to it, but you also have the habit mechanism because you've just done it so many times. And so, you know, I mean, if you just think about like dieting or quitting cigarettes, like very few people instantly get it on the first shot. You know, it just takes time to change behavior that has become habitual. And it's just like learning anything else. Like if you try to, I see there's a picture of a guy playing bass in the background and I can't see who it is because it's not close enough to me. But if you wanted to learn to play bass, you would not, you know, you wouldn't teach somebody by like shouting at them, play better. Like you'd have to give them some technique and they would suck at first. So, and if they didn't practice, they would continue to be bad. So, you know, it's like that, like you have to get new skills and it takes time to become good at these new skills and to get them ingrained. And this is, you know, whenever anybody tries to teach you something, they try to teach you the right way in the first place, because if you learn a bad habit at the beginning, it's much harder than if you, it's much harder to unlearn that than it is if you actually do your best at getting it right the first time. You know, and I mean, I've personally had this experience with things I'm trying to learn. And you know, so when we just, I think a lot of times people don't humanize addiction. They think it's like this alien, scary thing that like only happens to other bad people and that it is just not comparable to other human experience. And that's just not true. It's like a spectrum.
And I'm sure at this point, so many that would be thinking as a, well, how do you learn about drugs? How do you learn to use drugs? How do you learn that a drug could be some kind of a, I don't know. You get home and your parents get home and they automatically break out the bottle of wine or maybe have a glass of whiskey because that's the end of the day and it makes everything all better and everything's all good. And I can, yes, what, you know, when a kid watches that every day for years of their life, gee, I wonder how they could possibly think that using a substance was going to, I mean, even when the alcohol turns ugly.
Well, and the other thing there is that, like, for all of human history, every human culture has actually used psychoactive substances. There have been some claims that the Maori of New Zealand at some point didn't have them, but their ancestors did and their descendants did. you know, it's just like, you know, and even animals like altering their consciousness. Since I am a cat person, I think about catnip. It is, you know, it's just, it's part of human nature and part of nature. We like to alter consciousness. Things that we are experiencing are not always fun. And if we have the control to be able to try to change that, we're going to do it. I mean, all cultures also like have music, right? And some places, I heard this about Afghanistan recently, try to ban music. And it's just like, I just can't, I mean, that would be like the worst thing for me. But it's, you know, it's because it allows you to control your mood and people who want to control you don't like that. So there's always been sort of technologies for altering consciousness and they're throughout human culture. So even if you didn't watch your dad do it, once you become a teenager and you see, oh, look, if I take this, I feel differently. Like, it's just, you know, it's a thing that people do and a thing that people have always done. And rather than try to stomp it out, which we can't because we know that it has always continued, let's make it less harmful. And I think, you know, to me, the power of harm reduction is in making things less harmful is kind of a goal that everyone can agree on. Like, we don't necessarily want people getting euphoric, but to me, I care far more if somebody's going to get hurt than I care if they're going to get high. You get unearned euphoria, that's fine with me. You know, go for it. I don't think the government or any other person has any business interfering in, you know, whether people get euphoria or not. But I do think if there's going to be policy, which there needs to be, then we need the policy to focus on harm. And when we do that, the whole picture becomes very different, and you have to be humane, because if preventing harm is the most important thing, then you can't have this thing where, well, I'm going to make it harder and more difficult and more dangerous so that your kid will die as an example to mine. Like, you know, I mean, that, and I mean, when you think about it that way, that's what the drug war tries to do. It tries to make drug use as dangerous and unpleasant as possible to deter people. This does not work well, because the people who are most at risk for addiction already feel like, and so making that worse and trying to stop a condition that is defined by compulsive use despite negative consequences by using more negative consequences, it's just, you know, yeah, you might deter a couple of people who wouldn't have had a problem anyway, but you're not gonna, what you're gonna do is just oppress the people who are already most oppressed. And I think, and what harm reduction really says is, no, we want people to feel better and have better lives and not be hurt. And we're not concerned with like forcing them to learn something about pain.
This is my interview with the award-winning journalist and best-selling author Maya Solovitz. Her most recent book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction, has just been released in paperback. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's turn down to something that's the opposite of that. We started with a good news item. This is the bad news item. On Monday, August 22nd, California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed Senate Bill 57, which would have allowed a few municipalities to choose whether or not to open a supervised consumption site for a limited time, following New York City's lead in saving people's lives. What on earth is going on in California? And by the way, that's a question I've asked countless times over the years on a lot of different topics. But in this time, it's about harm reduction and preventing overdose deaths. What's up with Cali?
I mean, that, you know, what's up with that is that we have media that continues to focus on the horse race aspect of policy, as opposed to, does this policy work or not? Gavin Newsom is a politician. He wants to get elected. And all the media said he's going to be called Mr. Heroin if he doesn't, if he signs this. And so he feels like he has no choice, because he's in this environment where this is the media he's facing. Whereas if you had a rational media that would say, this policy works, we're going to support people who support the policy that works. And we're going to, you know, but it's just, you know, the thing about drug policy is it's just always a political football. Nobody really cares about what works. They care about, will this get me elected? And they care about, how can I send a racist message not explicitly? Now, I don't think a lot of politicians are conscious of, like, I'm going to go send a racist message. Some of them certainly are. But, you know, it just creates this terrible cycle where everybody has to go all in on things that don't work more and more and more.
Now, the other side of that is that shortly after the governor's veto, the city attorney for San Francisco and the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, announced that they want to proceed with plans to open a supervised consumption site. Somewhere in a report I saw an allegation that there's already an unauthorized supervised consumption site in San Francisco. Wouldn't surprise me. I'm guessing there are some of those in several cities around the country right now.
To me, what's just sad about this is, if you understand how harm reduction is about caring, like, there was this person who was tweeting about, she's a reporter, and she went to, you know, one of the San Francisco harm reduction sites, and she posted this picture of, look, I got all these needles and all this stuff and nobody offered me treatment. Well, you didn't ask, you know? And I mean, the thing is that, like, people assume that, like, oh, these people who are addicted, they've not thought about getting treatment. They've just, like, you know, they're just wandering around and they have no idea that 12-step programs exist. They have no idea that methadone exists. They have no idea, you know, that they might need help or anything like this. They're just walking around and waiting for somebody to say, hey, do you want treatment? You know, like, that is just not how it is. We have a terrible abusive treatment system, not all of it, but there's a lot of bad treatment out there. a lot of people with addiction are being mistreated all over the place. The only thing that they think is actually making their life bearable is the thing that they want to take away from them. So in order to get people into treatment, you have to build a relationship with them, and you have to help them find what their reason for being is and what will help them get through the difficult spots that come even in kind treatment. So it's, you know, if I walk into a restaurant and the first thing I say, you know, I think you might be drinking too much, like, I'm just going to go to another restaurant. Like, it's not, you know, I didn't go there for that. And you don't go to a syringe exchange for a treatment referral. You could if you wanted to, because they will, if you ask, they will happily refer you. And they have lots of ways of getting people into treatment that can jump waiting lists and stuff like this. But you know, it's just like, if I'm going somewhere that is, you know, aimed at people, just saving people's lives, and the first thing I'm going to get is the same message everybody else is sending me, which is, you're not worth anything unless you quit. I'm not going to go back to that place. I'm not going to find that place welcoming. But if I find a place welcoming, and I'm starting to, you know, question whether my drug use is healthy, then it's the most natural thing in the world to say, hey, you know, maybe I do want to stop. Do you know anything about that? What's available? Blah, blah. You know, because so many people who are working in harm reduction are in recovery themselves, and they will be absolutely delighted and happy to say, hey, this is what worked for me. It may not be what works for you, but this is how I did it. And here's, you know, some options. What a lot of people think about addiction is that, you know, if you're actively addicted, you can't make choices. You're just kind of the zombie who is driven by drugs. In reality, you know, and we can just look at the needle exchange literature for this, like, most people want to use clean needles. It's kind of gross not to do so. And also a lot healthier if you do use the sterile ones. So, you know, if people can change that behavior while they're still using, if people can save multiple lives by using naloxone, which many people who are actively using do, I mean, I've known people who've, you know, saved one person after another, you know, that's a very powerful thing also, right? But it's not like you're a zombie and you can't make choices or anything like that. And when you treat people as having agency and being able to make choices, again, they get better at doing it. And if you give people options, people are just more likely to, you know, take one of those options rather than just staying where they are. You know, there's a saying in harm reduction, meet people where they are, but don't leave them there. And that is what people often don't understand. You know, our culture is sort of just embedded in this moralistic view of addiction as something that needs to be kind of beaten out of you. And, you know, nothing nice can ever happen while you're actively addicted, because, like, otherwise, like, you'll never get in recovery. But it's just simply not true. It is completely falsified by all the research.
You know, I saw the tweet that you're referring to, the reporter who said they went undercover to a thing. And, you know, and in fairness, a healthy, middle-class, housed individual went pretending at a syringe exchange, and rather than say, hey, you're obviously a fake, they gave them supplies, thinking that this person, whatever their head trip is, may have a friend that they're trying to get product from, and they're just being weird. So they give them the supplies and the things to help their friend save, help their friend not die and not get sick.
And I know that people have gone to syringe exchanges and been like, oh, I want to start injecting, which is almost never, ever happens. But they won't give to them. That's a sort of complex moral dilemma. The notion that when you have a syringe exchange, on people are going to frequently come in off the street who don't have addictions and be like, oh my God, you have needles. I've always wanted to try injecting. Like, that just doesn't happen. You know, I mean, and it's just like, you know, and we know also from the fact that, like, for in many states for many years, you could just walk into a pharmacy and buy syringes. And the places where that's the case actually have far less IV drug use than the places that made syringes illegal. Not because having them available is such a fabulous thing, but because people make drug laws against syringes once they already have a drug problem, and then it doesn't solve them. It just ends up spreading bloodborne disease.
Yeah, Oregon, my home state, is one of those where they've been available from pharmacies without prescription for a very long time. And any number of people with diabetes who need to use their insulin have and found themselves traveling through Oregon and caught short have really, really been grateful for that. It's a really basic thing.
And I mean,
thing.
You know, the one criticism of needle exchange that I get is when people with diabetes say, like, hey, how come we don't get free needles? They should.
Exactly. Methadone, buprenorphine. Why should they? Well, actually, no. Why should you have to pay so much for your insulin? I mean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and that's like, to me, like, it's like, again, but that's kind of the thing where people just try to turn people who have less power against each other so they don't, like, rise up. And, you know, it's awful. You know, of course you should have, you know, it's, you know, and it does seem a bit bizarre to be like, well, we're going to prioritize these people because, like, oh, bloodborne disease is, like, horrible. There was a really interesting study early in the HIV epidemic where they compared rates of HIV among people who injected drugs who had diabetes versus people who didn't. Surprise, surprise, the people who had diabetes had far lower rates of HIV because they had access to clean needles. Now, it's sad that we needed that kind of study, but, you know, it just shows, like, the power of these myths we have about, like, oh, people don't care, people won't use clean ones, people, you know, like to, like, share other people's blood. Now, okay, there may be some kinky people who like that, and that's, you know, whatever. But the vast majority of people do not.
Yeah, that's vampirism, and we're not, it's no.
Exactly. And I don't want to stigmatize vampires, but the problem of bloodborne disease exists.
Far from. They can be a pain in the neck. So now let's look at some more good news. Thank you. So normally I have to point out when I've made a joke because no one can ever tell.
That's terrible.
And yeah. That was part one of my interview with Maya Solovitz, the award-winning journalist and best-selling author. Her most recent book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction, the first history of the movement aimed at focusing drug policy on minimizing harms, not highs, has just been released as a paperback. We'll hear part two of our conversation on next week's show. If you want to check out some of Maya's work, her website is mayasz.com. That's MAIASZ.com. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.